Thanks, Thomas, and I'd like to thank VFOR for inviting me to participate in this satellite symposium. First of all, my disclosures, which are shown here. My other disclosure, as Piotr has already alluded to, is that I'm not a cardiologist, I'm a nephrologist, so I don't apologise for that, but maybe I should. But anyway, I'm a nephrologist, and I think the reason I'm here is because iron for us is quite an old concept, whereas I think for cardiology it's a very new concept. I'm going to start with three interactive voting questions just to make sure you're awake. So if you wouldn't mind taking your voting pads and voting on where you think most iron physiologically is located in the human body. Can you vote now for 1, 2, 3, or 4? Okay, and the winner is, as you rightly say, is in red cells. We'll come back to that later, but it's interesting. Quite a few of you think it's in muscle and bone, but red cells is the correct answer. Okay, I'll move on to the second question, which is only three options now. And then we're going to discuss functional iron deficiency, and we'll discuss what that means in a minute. But just in the meantime, what do you understand as the most important underlying characteristic of functional iron deficiency? Is it high or normal body iron stores? If you want that, you vote for 1. Low body iron stores, 2. Depleted body iron stores, 3. If you can vote now. Okay, so it's a slightly trick question. I'm afraid most of you got this one wrong. And we'll discuss why. I mean, it doesn't make sense to have iron deficiency with high iron stores, or does it? So we'll come on to that in a minute. Last question really is, there's not a right or wrong answer here, so you can be very safe in how you vote. Do you consider Hepcidin, I don't know even if you've heard of Hepcidin, but hopefully by the end of this symposium you will know what it means, as a therapeutic target? In other words, something that you can build a therapeutic agent for treating iron deficiency and or anemia. Have you got yes, no, or do you have no opinion? So most of you, and the majority of you, have no opinion. So I'll hopefully show you that, in fact, there is number one is probably the correct answer, but it's very, very early days for this strategy. There's no right or wrong answer, really. So to move on, I'm going to cover 5 topics very briefly, and I emphasise very briefly because of the time, so maybe only 1 slide or 2 on each of these. I'm going to discuss the physiological importance of iron. Piotr has already alluded to some of that already. I'm going to talk about iron deficiency in patients with heart failure and why they get iron deficiency, how you detect and monitor iron deficiency in your patients, the role of Hepcidin, which we've just discussed in the last voting question, in iron availability, and then last but not least, how you would treat iron deficiency in the heart failure population. So we start with the physiological importance of iron, and I think it's fair to say that most of us, when we were medical students, learned about iron, and we thought of it as an important element in the synthesis of heme and hemoglobin and red cell development. And that is indeed true. Of course, erythropoietin is also very important as the hormone driving the bone marrow to make red cells and protecting these red cells against apoptosis. But iron features later in red cell development, and it's incorporated into the maturing red cell at the erythroblast and reticulocyte stage. And iron is critical because that is the element that impacts most on oxygen carrying capacity in the form of heme and hemoglobin. However, we now recognise that iron is essential for a number of other cellular processes beyond red cell development, particularly some enzymes, some proteins crucial for DNA synthesis, the transport of oxygen not only in hemoglobin but also myoglobin, transport of electrons, oxidative phosphorylation and the TCA cycle. So a huge number of other mechanisms that iron may be involved in that may be relevant to some of the effects that Piotr and colleagues saw in the FAIR-HF trial. And if we just summarise some of the physiological processes that are of most interest, they really are in terms of oxygen transport by hemoglobin, oxygen conservation by myoglobin, and energy generation in the form of generating ATP from ADP in being involved in the electron transport chain. So a huge number of roles for iron physiologically. And that has created a new hypothesis, which, again, Piotr has alluded to, that iron deficiency has some role in causing mitochondrial dysfunction and maybe the reasons why skeletal muscle and exercise capacity function is impaired. In terms of how we process iron, in a normal diet, you would expect to consume about 1 or 2 milligrams of iron a day. If you're not a meat eater, then you might not manage to 1 or 2 milligrams a day. So that's why a lot of vegans and vegetarians can become iron deficient. You also store it in a number of tissues, and we've already alluded to this, including muscle and bone marrow. But by far the greatest stores in the body are the red cells themselves at 1800 milligrams. You also lose iron every day. Even you and I lose iron every day in our stool. So it's occult gastrointestinal loss. That's due to desquamation of gut mucosal cells. And that quantitates, again, about 1 or 2 milligrams a day. So you can see a normal diet and a normal iron loss means you're in balance with iron. That is not true in quite a large number of pathological states, including kidney disease, particularly patients on dialysis, and also chronic heart failure, as we'll come to in a minute, and we can explain why this is the case shortly. So now that leads us on nicely to why patients with chronic heart failure might become iron deficient. And there are two mechanisms in play here. One is reduced intake, and the other is increased iron losses. So if you don't take enough in and you lose too much out, then you get a negative iron balance. So there are a number of factors why patients have not enough intake, in addition to them perhaps being vegetarian, which is not, of course, peculiar to heart failure. But a lot of heart failure patients get anorexic. They don't have a good appetite, so they don't eat as much, and that causes a decreased iron intake. They also absorb iron poorly from the gut, and we now recognise that that is due to hepcidin upregulation. And I'll come on to hepcidin just in a minute, but there's a new physiology that's been discovered in the last decade. Hepcidin was only discovered 10 years ago as a new peptide that I'll describe. But that is why a lot of patients, we think, with heart failure will not absorb iron from diet or from oral iron supplements. And then you've got some medications that the patient might be taking, such as proton pump inhibitors, that might interact with iron and stop its absorption. And there are lots of foodstuffs, such as tea and other things, that can inhibit iron absorption. And then on the other side, you may have patients that are losing more than 1 or 2 milligrams of iron in the gut by occult gastrointestinal blood loss. And of course, you treat many of your patients with aspirin and clopidogrel and other grels and warfarin and for atrial fibrillation, and that enhances iron losses from the gut. So it's very easy to see how patients with heart failure can end up in negative iron balance. So why can you look at this? How can you measure iron deficiency and detect it in your patient population? Well, iron is a closed loop. As I say, you take in 1 or 2 milligrams a day, you lose 1 or 2 milligrams a day, and this is a closed loop. You store iron in the reticular endothelial system, in macrophages, in the spleen and liver. That feeds the plasma, which feeds the bone marrow. The bone marrow makes the red cells. The red cells die off after 120 days, and the iron is then recirculated back into the store. So it's a closed loop. So how can you look at this? Well, laboratory tests are not ideal. You can send off a ferritin level to your biochemistry lab, and that will give you an approximation of iron stores. There's a good correlation between serum ferritin and total body iron stores. So it's not perfect, but it's the best we've got. In the plasma, we can measure serum iron, we can measure the total iron binding capacity, and we can compute the transferrin saturation, or TSAT. That's fine. It's also got limitations. Of course, we can measure also this transferrin receptor in the serum, more an experimental tool, and I'm not sure it has a great deal to offer in routine clinical practice, but some laboratories have access to this. And then, as Piotr said, with one of the studies, they performed bone marrow examinations, and you can, of course, do this in your patients. It's a bit invasive. Most patients prefer a blood test to a bone marrow, but you can stain the iron in the marrow and look how much iron is there, and that's also possible if you really want to subject your patient to a bit of trauma. And then you can actually look at some things in the red cells themselves. What is the percentage of red cells that are hypochromic? Because red cells that have iron deficiency in them become hypochromic. So look at the percentage of the red cell population that are hypochromic. Again, this is an experimental one. I don't think I would recommend it, and it's not widely available, which is the red blood cell zinc protoporphyrin level. I don't think we can say any more about that. And then also the reticulocyte hemoglobin content's been used. So you've got a lot of laboratory tests available. They tell you different parts of the iron metabolism pathway, but none of them are ideal. I'm not going to go through all the limitations. This then alludes to the second question that I said, interactive voting. It's very obvious now that there are two types of iron deficiency. There's absolute iron deficiency, where basically it's like a current account in a bank, but you've run out of money. You have absolutely no money left, and you have no body iron stores left. Your serum ferritin level is low, roughly less than 100, or transferrin saturation less than 20%. You have run out of iron. And then you've got functional iron deficiency, which is the one we asked the question about, which in terms of the bank means you've got lots of money in the bank, but unfortunately you cannot get the money out because you've got to wait 25 years for the policy to mature. So that's a functional iron deficiency, plenty of iron stores, in fact, in many cases, increased body iron stores, but an inability to release them to the bone marrow. So that's characterized by normal or high serum ferritin levels, as was the interactive voting question, and a transferrin saturation less than 20%. So these are the two types of iron deficiency. So back to heart failure again, and this goes back to the study that Piotr presented and was a co-author on, which is the prevalence of iron deficiency in heart failure. And it's clear now that in heart failure you have three scenarios. You can have patients that are anemic, you can have patients that are iron deficient with no anemia, and you can have patients with both who have got iron deficient anemia. And Piotr's already discussed the prevalence of iron deficiency in heart failure, 57% with anemia and 32% without anemia. Quite large prevalences if you look at the heart failure population. So now we come on to the new kid in the block with iron, which is hepcidin. So hepcidin is a little 25 amino acid peptide. It comes out of the liver and it controls, it's the master regulator of iron metabolism. So it controls the iron to the plasma pool. It controls uptake of iron from the duodenum from the gut into the plasma pool. And if it's upregulated, that is why patients that are not that are taking normal dietary iron don't absorb it into the plasma pool. And the reticular endothelial system also will not release iron from its stores. So that causes a functional iron deficiency. We know at a molecular level how this works. Hepcidin binds to this ferroportin molecule. I'm not going to go into molecular biology, but that's been ascertained in the last year or two. And then, so we have different clinical conditions now. Patients with low hepcidin levels, hopefully most of us will be able to absorb iron well. It'll get out of the cell with ferroportin as the channel for getting iron out of the cell again. In patients with high hepcidin levels, such as those with perhaps chronic heart failure or my population, which is chronic kidney disease, the iron's trapped in the cell. It cannot get out because ferroportin is bound to hepcidin and that iron exporter mechanism is inhibited. And therefore, iron is not absorbed from the gut, it's not released from the stores, and you get this functional iron deficiency. So that brings me on to the last topic very briefly, treating iron deficiency. Clearly, you've got oral treatment and you've got intravenous treatment. Oral is great. It's very simple in the UK. It causes a few pence a week for treating the patient, and there are many ferrous brands on the market, such as this ferrous sulfate, that you can buy. You can even buy some syrup, which allows you to, I don't know if you can see this, but this is marketed for anemia and overwork. So if you feel overworked, you can buy some of this syrup. But the problem really is that they don't work particularly well. They also cause terrible gastric irritation due to the fenton reaction in the gut mucosa, so they cause gastrointestinal side effects. They're very irritant to the gut mucosa by this reaction. And that, of course, means that a lot of patients don't like to take them. They recognize that when they take their iron, they get gut ache. And so up to 20% of patients will become constipated and get dyspepsia and bloating and nausea and diarrhea and heartburn, and that stops them taking their iron in. You can make that better by saying take the iron with food, but if you take it with food, then it doesn't get absorbed, so it defeats the purpose of giving the iron. And then, if, say, absorption is limited by hepcidin upregulation. So what can you do about this? Well, the first thing is that most patients won't take oral iron. A lot of them will not. Well, they may not admit it to you, but because of the gut side effects, they're just not taking the oral iron in the way they say they are. So that brings me on then to intravenous iron to finish off with. So all the intravenous irons that are on the market worldwide have iron in the middle. Iron is very toxic. If you'd injected iron straight into your patients, it would be fatal. So you have to put it round, coat it with a carbohydrate shell to make it safe. And then the iron can be released slowly from the carbohydrate shell and then taken up by transferrin in the plasma. There are different sizes of carbohydrate shell. You've got the small ones, like small molecular weight gluconate, slightly bigger sucrose, and the massive dextrin molecules which coat the iron. And then, of course, you know, for the purposes of today, there's a new carbohydrate, carboxymaltose, which is midway between iron dextran and iron sucrose. And the size of the carbohydrate chain influences how rapidly the iron is released from the iron complex. So intravenous iron works better than oral iron. It bypasses the hepcidin blockade of poor iron absorption. So this is my last slide just to conclude. So iron plays a central role in the uptake, transport, storage and metabolism of oxygen. I think that's clear. That's what we've learned in the last few years. We have some ways of monitoring iron status in the laboratory. All of them, unfortunately, have limitations. And we now recognize that this new peptide that was discovered by a medical student doing some research in Paris 10 years ago is the key regulator of iron availability. And there are already several scientists and companies working on trying to target hepcidin as a means of correcting functional iron deficiency, and maybe even in the future in heart failure. And intravenous iron has a number of advantages over oral iron for treating iron deficiency and heart failure, as Piotr has already alluded to. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Ian, for this very nice talk that puts a complex situation into an educational framework that we can understand. Dr. Bernardo has a question.
Is there any side effect on the intestinal tract? Because we know it from the tablets, the intestinal tract, constipation and all the other things, dyspepsia.
Is there any side effect with the oral iron or the intravenous?
No, only with the intravenous.
No, intravenous iron, because it's bypassing the gut, you don't get any
Not
side
at all.
It's very unusual. I use a lot of oral intravenous iron. If someone gets any gut symptoms, I don't think it's the iron. I think it's something else. It's so rare. It's only with oral iron.
So if hepcidin is regulated by cytokines, I understand.
Yes.
So any patient that has an inflammation, which is anemia, will actually not respond to oral treatment.
Correct, So the main driver of hepcidin, I didn't say it, is interleukin-6, and to a lesser extent, tumor necrosis factor alpha. And, of course, they're upregulated in inflammation, and that's what drives hepcidin. Yeah. So that's why oral iron won't work.
So you showed the phantom reaction in our gut. If we swallow it, why doesn't this occur when we inject it? Because in vitro and in the lab, we use, of course, iron to produce oxidative stress regularly.
Yeah.
And we all say that's not good for you.
Absolutely. It's a very good question, Thomas. And I don't want to pretend that oxidative stress is not relevant for intravenous iron. There are a lot of laboratory tests that if you take intravenous iron preparations and you take them into the lab and you do your test tube experiments, you can show that intravenous iron increases oxidative stress in the test tube. When you extrapolate that into clinical practice, and there have been several studies done in dialysis patients showing that it doesn't increase oxidative stress any more than dialysis does. But it is a relevant question. It is one of the things that we're concerned about in terms of lipid peroxidation and free oxygen radicals. So it is a good question. Thanks.
Yes. What about allergic reactions giving intravenous iron?
Allergic reactions. Yes. Yeah, allergic reaction, true allergy reactions, and when we say allergy, I mean immunologically mediated reactions, are really only occurring with iron dextran. That is because some of us have preformed dextran antibodies in our body, and that's an allergic reaction. And you may be aware, in days gone by, patients had anaphylactic death with iron dextran preparations. That does not occur with the other iron preparations, which cause anaphylactoid reactions very rarely, where it's more a vasodilatory reaction, slight fall in blood pressure, slight lightheadedness. That is not an anaphylactic reaction. It's not immunologically mediated. And it's due to too much free iron leaking out of the complex too rapidly.
Yes, please.
Is there any problem in this population with heart failure patients who suffer from cancer too?
So the oncology literature has blossomed in the last few years. And 20 years ago, nephrologists were interested in intravenous iron. In the last few years, oncologists and cardiologists have really become very interested because there are now 5 randomized controlled trials in oncology which saw some benefits of intravenous iron. So I think it's a very topical area at the moment.
Another question?
Do you think that is a superior effect if you would give APO with your intravenous iron?
They're additive, there's no doubt. I mean, in some patients, a lot of the patients I look after are EPO deficient and iron deficient because EPO comes from the kidneys, obviously. For your heart failure patients, some of them will be EPO deficient, there's no doubt about that, particularly the ones with some renal insufficiency, and they might benefit from EPO. You're probably aware there's a large randomized control trial by Amgen, the RED-HF study, looking at EPO therapy or darbepoetin alfa therapy against placebo in the heart failure population. And we need that study very badly to see if ESA, if EPO therapy is a benefit in heart failure.
And Hollywood star said, too much of a good thing is wonderful. Does this apply for iron as well? Or can we have too much of it?
Well, I thought you were going to say EPO, because with EPO...
Well, that's clear, yeah.
We know that
from the Tour de France, yeah.
Okay. Yeah, well, not only in the Tour de France, in kidney patients, the TREAT study, which was published in the New England Journal a year ago, showed that too much EPO is a bad thing also. So
there was stroke, so.
Yeah, there was doubling of stroke rate in that study. So I think EPO is, we're worried about. Now, the question is too much iron bad? I think we need a very good randomized controlled trial to look at lots of iron versus a little bit of iron.
Would there be more excretion if we were to give too much?
More excretion of iron.
Iron, yeah. Would it compensate for it? Not necessarily.
It's not really excreted. No. It would just end up in the reticular endothelial system.
Yeah.
That's where it would end up. Yeah.
Right.